On this episode of the For Got Sonya Project, we conclude our conversation with Marion Cornelius about the incredible history of Camp Ellis, a massive World War II Army camp that was located right here in rural For Got Sonya.
For Got Sonya, like a lot of stated proposals, they felt like they were kind of being left out. If you look at a map of Illinois, there are a lot of freeways in Illinois, but For Got Sonya didn't have the freeway they wanted. Well, they couldn't get that freeway built. We're going to create our own little state called For Got Sonya.
So if you weren't able to listen to the first portion of our talk with Marion about Camp Ellis, I'd recommend you go back and listen. Marion Cornelius is the director of the Easley Pioneer Museum in Ipava, Illinois, which holds the largest collection of artifacts from Camp Ellis. Our previous conversation focused on some of the basics about Camp Ellis, like where the camp is located, how large it is, and why Camp Ellis was built in the first place. We took special attention to point out misconceptions people often have about Camp Ellis, such as the fact that Camp Ellis wasn't used to train soldiers to fight, but rather to support the war effort. On this episode, I asked Marion about African American soldiers that served at Camp Ellis, notable visitors that have come to the museum, and what he feels is the legacy of Camp Ellis. So I'm excited to share this portion of our talk and hope you enjoy. What can you tell us about African American soldiers that served in Camp Ellis? We understand that there's been a heightened interest in this topic lately.
I didn't realize this was happening until about 3 years ago, mm-hmm. until I started to get phone calls wanting to know about it. Julie and I have been researching it quite a bit, and we're finding out a few things, but not a great deal. There wasn't, you got to remember, no television. There were very few moving pictures of Camp Ellis, or that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Most all pictures are in black and white, and there isn't a lot to be found, although we're digging up a few things here and there. There were black units at Camp Ellis, mm-hmm. And then the question comes of how were they treated? And that's a hard one to answer. I can't really answer this is just kind of my opinion, that yeah. I think they were treated pretty well at Camp Ellis. They were treated pretty equally. I think they were into all three different disciplines that were being trained at Camp Ellis. Mm. And I think on the camp, everything was pretty good. The things that we have found out, that it was a little different when they left the camp.
Yeah.
When they went to the surrounding communities, the surrounding communities, with the exception of Peoria, there weren't very many blacks in the surrounding communities. So it was a typical problem of anywhere that you would find north of the Mason-Dixon line.
Yeah.
There were restaurants they couldn't go into. There were hotels they couldn't go into.
So I wanted to take a moment just to share that the Easley Pioneer Museum just posted recently some further information about this question. According to the book Camp Ellis, Illinois, From Cornfields to Marching Feet, it's a book that's going to be mentioned later on in our interview, Brigadier General Benjamin O. Davis from the Office of the Inspector General visited Camp Ellis. Davis served on the Advisory Committee on Negro Troops Policies from 1941 to 1944. He conducted inspection tours of African American soldiers in the U.S. Army, and after spending 5 days at Camp Ellis, he stated that there was no complaints of racial discrimination from any African American soldiers, and that African American soldiers here were more contented and better satisfied than at any other camp he had visited. Now, that's significant, as General Davis was the first officer, African American officer, to rise to the rank of Brigadier General. It's also worth noting that his son, Benjamin Davis Jr., followed in Dad's footsteps, becoming just the fourth African American to graduate from West Point and the first African-American since 1889. In fact, when Davis Jr. graduated, there were just two black officers in the Army, he and his dad. Davis Jr. actually is better known because he was the one that commanded the Tuskegee Airmen in World War II and became the first African-American general of the Air Force. He's even been featured in several movies fairly recently. So we're going to post a link online that you can read more about this really, really storied career of General Davis. So what's left of Camp Ellis today?
Okay, if you would have gotten your group to come, mm-hmm. and we would have spent, depending on how, if you'd have gotten your group to come, would you have brought a bus?
Yeah, I would have brought a bus, yep.
Okay.
If you
would have gotten the group to come, we would have spent an hour or two in the museum, and then we probably would have worked it so that we could took a tour of the camp with them on the bus.
Oh, that'd be terrific.
It wouldn't be the first time for a Cuba bus on the campgrounds.
Okay.
About 10 years ago, let's see, I have to think now, 9 or 10 years ago, there's a fella, and I'm not going to be able to get his name, I've got it over at the museum, but I won't get it off the top of my head now. Mm-hmm. He's probably about 90, 93, 94, somewhere in that range now.
Okay.
He was a veteran, and his unit that he was in, and if I remember right, he was one of those that served at the last of World War II and then served again in Korea. And his unit would get together every year somewhere in the United States for a reunion.
Mm-hmm.
And this particular year, they gathered in Cuba where he lived. He was the one that got the reunion going in Cuba. And if I remember right, there were about 20-some, and he got a Cuba bus and brought them to the museum.
Yeah.
And the bus happened to have a PA system in it.
Yeah.
And so after we did the thing in the museum, why, then I took them out. They took me and went out and gave them a tour of the camp.
Oh,
and
that's cool.
The one thing that if people don't know about Camp Ellis after they take a tour, and we do have, in the museum, we do have a driving tour map of the camp. It's possible to go out there and drive through the camp because it's huge. Anyway, the interesting thing to me about the driving tour in the Cuba school bus was that there wasn't one of the guys who had been at Camp Ellis. They just wanted to learn the story about Camp Ellis and what it was like, how big it was, same things you're wanting to know.
Yeah.
But when I took them out there and started saying, this is where the hospital was, this is where the prisoner of war camp was. For instance, you were talking to me a while ago about what's still out there. One of the things that's concrete and still out there are two huge water towers, two huge concrete water towers that supplied the city. And the amazing thing to me, it was one of the best days I've had as far as the museum is concerned, because I would say this is where the prisoner of war camp and this is where the rifle range was, and those guys' eyes got big as moons. Their mouth would drop open. But the amazing thing was about it is they weren't seeing Camp Ellis at all. I started noticing that I'd say one thing and then another thing, and their mouth would drop open and they'd say Camp Lejeune or whatever camp was that they were in.
Yeah.
While we're touring Camp Ellis, they were, in their mind, they were touring where they took their training.
Yeah.
It was really a fantastic day.
Yeah. Could you share about any notable visitors that have come to visit the Camp Ellis artifacts at the museum?
Had a really good visit late last summer.
Mm-hmm.
The second most written about German prisoner of war ended up coming back to the United States and living in Madison, Wisconsin. He and his son had a tombstone business. They did tombstone work and built memorials all around the Midwest. And he died about, I think 5 years ago, but his son came. And he did the same thing when I took a tour out with him. He said, oh, at one, he was driving. I was in the back seat of his pickup truck, and he was driving it. One point, he just, he and his wife were in the front, and he just stopped, and he turned around and looked at me, and he said, oh, my God. My dad told me stories about this place, but I had no idea that it was this kind of size. That was a was a good trip. The other one that I might relate that your students would like, I think, is that one day I had this. I don't think that I know of. I don't think I've had a person in the museum who was a prisoner of war. Of course, they're all expiring now. I have a guy. His name is Bill Kramer. And he comes every fall and gives a talk. And he was a guard for prisoners of war. I think he has been there 11 years now, and he is the youngest 94 I know of. He lied about his age to get into the service. Oh, wow. So he's younger than most, and he will be there on Camp Ellis Days on Saturday of Camp Ellis Days this fall. And I, at least I expect him to make it. Unless something happens, he will be there again. He's pretty interesting, but he was a, when he was at Camp Ellis, he was a guard for prisoners of war.
Okay.
I'm at the museum one day, just an ordinary day. There didn't happen to be anybody there at that particular time. And four really pretty cute gals come walking in their late 20s. And I said hi and introduced myself, and we started talking. And the one gal that was kind of the leader of the four, she said, I'm from Texas. And I said, okay. And she introduced me to the other three, and she said, they're all from Germany. And I said, sprechen Sie Deutsch? And boy, they just perked right up. I don't speak a lot of German, but I say a few things. And as soon as I said that, well, I got their attention. A fairly short story, but it kind of answers your question about who's been at the museum, how far did they come. The gal from Texas, she was an exchange student when she was in high school, and she went to Germany, and she made three really close friends. And after she came home, she said, if you ever get the chance, you have to come visit me in Texas. So it's maybe 10 years later or 12 when they came, something like that. Anyway, they went to Texas to visit their friend, and they hadn't been there very long, and they didn't really have a good idea about the size of the United States. German people, Germany is pretty small in terms of the United States, and German people over here get a little lost in the vastness, so to speak. And so these three girls get to where she is, and she said, one of the girls said to her, my uncle was a prisoner of war at Camp Ellis. And another one said, a friend of my mother's was a prisoner of war at Camp Ellis. All three of those girls had a connection with a prisoner of war who spent his time at Camp Ellis. So they're looking at her, and they said, can we visit Camp Ellis? Well, they're in Texas. It's a long way. She drove those, the four of them drove from Texas to Ipava so they could see Camp Ellis. And they came in and were just completely fascinated. Because, and to make the end of this story more important, in all three instances, there were three different guys who were prisoners of war, but in all three instances, they didn't have a thing bad to say about Camp Ellis. Their time at Camp Ellis, in fact, this story just keeps happening over and over when I get stories about prisoners of war. They didn't want to go back. And there's a long story, I won't go into it very much, but a long story about Reinhold Pobel, Reinhold Pobble was the only. There were quite a few different escapes from Camp Ellis, but they weren't escaping to escape. They were escaping because they wanted to be out.
Yeah.
They weren't trying to get back to Germany. In fact, they probably didn't know how to get back to Germany, but they just wanted to be out. Okay, the only successful escape was Reinhold Pobble, and he wrote a book about it. We've got the book in the museum. It's really good.
Oh, cool.
And most of the prisoners of war at Camp Ellis were from Rommel's troops in North Africa. Not all of them, but I would say probably somewhere around 75% of them came from Rommel's troops.
Okay.
Anyway, one of the things they did with prisoners of war at Camp Ellis, they took them to Washington, Illinois. There was a Libby's canning plant in Washington. And when he escaped, he didn't escape from Camp Ellis. He escaped from the Libby's canning plant, and he really didn't escape. They just worked there like regular workers, but they had a place they had to go back to be every night. And that place where they stayed had a fence around it, but he just raised up the barbed wire and stepped through the fence. And his advantage was he could speak English. He could speak seven languages, but he could speak English.
Oh, my goodness.
And he hitched a ride to Chicago. He hitched a ride to Peoria, and he had saved up some money, which they weren't supposed to have money, but he managed to put together a little bit. I think he had $15 when he started. And he bought a ticket, and I don't know whether he bought a train ticket or a bus ticket. I think it was a bus ticket, from Peoria to Chicago. Got a job in a restaurant, washed dishes in a restaurant, saved his money. His family in Germany had bookstores, so he ends up buying a bookstore, marrying a gal from Chicago. They had a child, and it wasn't until, I think it was 1954, when the FBI finally caught up with him. But he had the wherewithal then. Because of the Geneva Convention, he had to go back to Germany. But he had some help from friends, and he had the wherewithal to be able to get all the red tape taken care of. So he ended up living most of his life back in the Chicago area. There's a lady, her name is, her maiden name was Crabb, Mary Kerr.
Okay.
And she has written two books about the prisoners of war who were housed in Washington. She lives in Washington now. She was originally from Macomb, but she lives in Washington now. And she wrote the first book, and then she was given a talk about her book in Macomb, and Julie happened to be there for the talk and told her about the museum. She came to the museum, and I think she spent something like 9 or 10 days in the museum, and wrote another book, and include quite a lot about Camp Ellis in that book. She had a little bit about Camp Ellis in the first one, but they're both in the museum. They're both pretty interesting. In fact, the second one, I'm sitting at my desk at home now, and I've got a box right here with about, I think I got 14 of her books in it. We're selling those at the museum.
Please tell us when the museum is open, and also share a little bit about Camp Ellis Days, especially for those that have never heard of this event.
Museum brochures. I thought I had them right here, but I don't see one.
Yeah.
The back page on our museum brochure says when we're open, and we're open on, I think I told you this before, Tuesdays and Fridays from April till November.
Okay.
And won't open until the other museums around the state start opening up this year. Mm-hmm. And we're open 3 weekends. The 3 weekends that we are open is, the one weekend is what's called IPAVA Homecoming Camp Ellis Days, and it's the weekend after Labor Day every year.
Okay.
We're open Friday, Saturday, Sunday of that weekend. And there's that weekend we probably have most years we have about 2,000 people through the museum that weekend.
Oh wow.
the parade attracts a lot of people downtown, and the museum attracts quite a lot of people, not just because of the museum, but a lot of people don't like porta potties when they come to the museum. The museum is just two blocks off the square in Ipava. And so that's a busy weekend. The other two weekends that we're open are the weekends of Spoon River Drive. Have you been able to get a hold of From Cornfields to Marching Feet by Marjorie Wardner?
No, I've not heard of that.
That's my Bible.
Okay, what's it called again?
So to speak,
From Cornfields?
Marjorie Wardner is from Canton. She was originally from McDonough County. She lived in, she grew up in Bardolph, and she taught, later in life, she taught at Western. And she wrote a book. I'm not remembering now just when it was. It was in the 80s that she wrote the book. And she let it be known around the country that anybody that had an experience at Camp Ellis, if they would write about it in a letter and send it to her, she'd publish it.
Mm-hmm.
And what she did was she took the Camp Ellis book. There is a book, that a hardcover book that was printed at Camp Ellis in 1945, I think it was. It was kind of late in the war anyway.
Okay.
And it's a picture book with a lot written in it about the things that were, how the training took place at Camp Ellis. It's a really good book. They're a little hard to find. Last time I saw one on eBay, I think the title of that book is just Camp Ellis. We've got one copy of it in the museum, but last time I saw it on eBay, a guy wanted $600 for it.
Oh,
I didn't buy it.
Wow.
But I did have a guy that donated one to the museum, so I've got that book. Okay, she took that book, and the first half of her book is that book in its entirety, and then she added material that of her own to it, and then she added all these letters that people had with their experience of Camp Ellis.
Okay.
And I'm continually going back through those letters because I learn something every time I read about it. And when I first read it, some of the letters didn't make sense to me. Now then, after I've learned a lot about Camp Ellis, when I go back and read the letters, then it makes a whole lot more sense. So a lot of what I say comes from that book. And the book is entitled From Cornfield to Marching Feet. By Marjorie Wardner, and we used to sell them at the museum, but we've run out of them, and Marjorie died about, one of the last times I was in Cuba. She was at the nursing home right down the street from where you live.
Oh, yeah.
And that's where she was when she died.
Yeah.
I'm still in contact with her daughter. I don't think her daughter is going to, after her mother went to the nursing home, she did one reprint, but I don't think she's going to do another one.
Mm.
It's kind of an expensive thing to do. It's a hardback book.
Yeah.
When we were selling them, they were $58. If we didn't make any money, that was just what it cost to produce the book.
Yeah.
But if you can get a hold of one of those, I wouldn't be too surprised that there's not one in, there might be one in your library. And if there's not, you get to talking to somebody around Cuba that's familiar with Camp Ellis, and you probably can find somebody that's got one.
So the last question that I have for you is, why is it important for people to remember Camp Ellis today? Could you please share about the legacy of the camp?
Okay. Now, I guess the biggest comment I can make is that probably your students are old enough to have heard Tom Brokaw's description of that era, the greatest generation.
Yeah.
Okay, I've said many times to people in the museum, he didn't get it right.
Interesting, yeah.
When he said the greatest generation. All of the things that I've learned about Camp Ellis, and I learned a lot before we started that. I was kind of a history nut as far as Camp Ellis was concerned anyway. Mm-hmm. The Greatest Generation, that's not a good description of what those people did during that period of time. It's bigger than that. I don't know what to call it, but it's bigger than the Greatest Generation. They did some things that we... In fact, now that you ask the question, I'm sitting here thinking about it. Mm-hmm. What we need today is a repeat of the Greatest Generation, and we're not fighting a shooting war today. Mm-hmm. And we're not getting it today. There are too many people that aren't taken seriously that they could die from this, and thousands of people could die.
Yeah, yeah.
And what happened at Camp Ellis with the Greatest Generation, for instance, if you come to the museum, we've got a little display of a pair of twins that grew up in Ipava. They joined up right out of high school, that pair of twins died on the same day in different places in Europe. And there are, Ipava was a little town, 650 people. It's smaller than Cuba at the time. And I think there were about 9 that died from Ipava. I guess I've never counted them all up. And every little town was the same way. The best of the male production of the community was off fighting, and everybody else was supporting that. So what did Camp Ellis mean, and why is it important to not forget that it happened? The second largest city in Illinois was just to support the effort of World War II, and it all resulted within a month of what happened at Pearl Harbor. And the things that we accomplished they're sort of indescribable. For instance, have you ever read The Manhattan Project? Okay, it's a big, thick book, and it's worth your read if you can find it. The Manhattan Project is basically, it's the atomic bomb. What it took to build it.
Yeah.
Okay, they started the Manhattan Project, I think about 2 years before. They knew things were going sour in Europe, and things were going sour with Japan and China. And the Manhattan Project started. So all of the things that you can see that happened at Camp Ellis, the Manhattan Project was going on before and after Camp Ellis. And the amount of time, energy, money, and knowledge that was spent to accomplish the Manhattan Project is indescribable.
Yeah.
And what they did at Camp Ellis is sort of indescribable. Okay, my son lived in Arizona he now lives in Alaska, but he lived in Arizona for almost 30 years, and he and I both fly. So every time I go out there, he has his own airplane, and every time I go out there, I don't fly anymore unless I'm with him. Mm-hmm. But every time I go out there, we fly. And I didn't keep track, because we've flown all over Utah, Arizona, Colorado, New Mexico.
Yeah, cool.
I didn't keep track of them, but when you fly, every so often, you see a triangular airport on the ground. And with two or three exceptions, all that's there is the old blacktop runway. Mm-hmm. Or in some cases concrete, and they laid them out as a triangle, and each side of the triangle is about a mile long. Mm-hmm. So that you could land or take off in about any direction. And all of those were built at the same time that Camp Ellis was built.
Oh, wow.
So the amount of things that happened, and then if your students want to get into something that boggles my mind, maybe they can do this. Just try and find out how many 4x4s, how many Jeeps, how many half tracks. Half tracks were built in Springfield, Illinois, in an old Alice Chalmers plant. How many tanks? How many C-47s? How many P-51s? How many P-38s? How many LSTs? How many battleships? The things that were done, in fact, the LSTs, one of the LST plants was somewhere up in the Chicago area, and they brought them all down the Illinois River.
Wow.
They had to go down the Illinois. Another one was, I can't remember now which town it is. It's an Indiana town up the Ohio River. And so all those, you know what an LST is?
No.
LST is Landing Craft Tank. It's the ship that's kind of square nosed that they could put several tanks on it, or several trucks, or a whole bunch of Jeeps,
okay,
and take them right up on the beach, and the nose would flop down, and they drive everything. It was the main thing that was being used to get them on the beach at Normandy.
Oh, gotcha.
But there's a project for one of your students. Just try and figure out how many of those things, how many big 27 cylinder engines were built to fly airplanes during that period of time, and how quickly we did that. Somebody needs, and I think we're doing it. We're just not, the whole country is not behind the effort that it needs to be to get the problem solved with this virus. Nazism and the ideas that took place in Japan, that was like a virus. And if it hadn't have been for Camp Ellis, if it hadn't have been for all of those Air Force bases and all the Rosie the Riveters that built the airplanes, we'd all be speaking German now.
So that concludes our conversation with Marion Cornelius, and we cannot thank him enough. He is the director of the Easley Pioneer Museum. This episode focused on African Americans serving at Camp Ellis, notable visitors to Camp Ellis, and the overall legacy of the camp. To quickly recap some major points from this episode, first, while there's not much evidence about how African Americans serving at Camp Ellis were treated, it was likely that any mistreatments came from surrounding towns rather than the camp itself, as there were restaurants and hotels that did not allow African Americans in. There was one successful escape attempt from Camp Ellis by a German soldier named Reinhold Pabel. He wasn't caught until 1954 in Chicago, and he had a family. He had a family by then, and there's a great book about Reinhold's life that I'm going to reference down below in just a second. And then the final main point is that the legacy of the camp. Marion shares how the amount of time, energy, and money put into the World War II effort was simply indescribable, something that we have not witnessed since. I really like how he likens it to the virus that we're experiencing today. So if you have any questions or comments for Marion about Camp Ellis, please don't hesitate. Comment on our webpage, forgottoniaproject.com. I'd encourage you to follow the Easley Pioneer Museum's Facebook page. They post some outstanding resources and videos about all things Camp Ellis history. Of course, hopefully soon, when the museum opens, the best thing you can do is simply make the trip out yourself to visit Marion in person in Ipava, Illinois. In the meantime, if you'd like to hear from him directly, you can email Marion at pmcorn@mtcnow. That's pmcorn@mtcnow. and I'm sure he will be happy to speak with you. A few books that have been mentioned in this podcast and additionally are also going to be linked on our website. I just referenced Reinhold Papel's book called Enemies Are Human. Some of these books are tough to get. You got to be creative. Maybe look in your local library, look on Amazon, or see if they're selling it at the Easley Museum. But just look on our website for this information and more. Thanks for listening.